I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The last time American labor unions stood shoulder to shoulder was the presidential election. It was a triumph of organization. Thousands of paid workers, hundreds of thousands of volunteers brought record numbers of voters to the polls. Trouble was, it fell short. See, there just isn't the same muscle that there once was in organized labor. 20 years ago, one out of every five workers in America carried a union card. Now it's closer to one of every eight. The slipping power of the unions is causing some bruising internal debate this week as members of the AFL-CIO gather in Las Vegas. There's criticism of the leadership, talk of the need for some dramatic reorganization, even the possibility of a split. Now, the unions agree on one thing. Nothing's going to get any better unless they can sign up new members. That means trying to figure out what it will take to get people thinking that they'd be better off with a union. Well, so what do you think? Why don't unions have the numbers they once did? Are labor organizers simply being outmaneuvered by the Walmarts? Would you sign to join a union at your workplace? Or has the time and is the power of the union passed us? Our number's 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're going to start this hour with David Moberg. He is covering the meeting in Las Vegas. He's senior editor of In These Times. That's an alternative news magazine based in Chicago. David wrote a recent article called Labor Debates Its Future. It was published last month in The Nation. David, it's nice to have you with us.
Great to be with you.
Can you tell me if you look at this as some kind of internal fight, a family squabble at the top over what the union's supposed to be, or are the people there recognizing that they've got a real problem on their hands?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I don't think that the problem would internally would be anywhere near what it is if it weren't for the external problems. There's a debate going on to some extent about whether it's possible to organize on a large scale when the external conditions for organizing are as bad as they are. It's actually, over the last 10, 15 years, according to most public polling, the number of Americans who would like a union or some other organization representing them at work has gone up. Mm-hmm. It's something on the order of at least 45%. And that's obviously much larger than the 12.5% who actually belong to unions. That's 45% of those who don't have a union right now. So there is some interest from workers in being represented and having some voice at work. It's just that, as you mentioned with Walmart, in a recent campaign to organize a very small auto service unit in Colorado, the company fired somebody. They brought in new anti-union workers to the unit. They brought in a ton of managers who showed anti-union videos, who talked one-on-one, who implicitly threatened that those jobs were at stake. And under that kind of firepower, a lot of the workers who had already said that they wanted to join a union voted against it.
So is this just one, you know, tough-ass employer who's saying no to unions? Or are you saying that the whole political climate has changed, making it harder for people to run a membership drive and push for unions?
Well, the corporate climate has certainly changed over the period of the last several decades.
Yeah.
And so now the vast majority of union organizing campaigns face that kind of employer opposition. And the crazy thing is that even companies that are based in Europe and have, you know, virtually wall-to-wall union representation in their European operations and have learned to live and prosper with unions there come to the United States and begin behaving like American employers and doing everything they can to fight against unionization.
David, I wonder if you can just help me with a little bit of a checklist of what we're hearing is going on in Las Vegas, or what is that sort of at the top of the docket. Andy Stern with the Service Employees International Union saying, look, we need these kinds of dramatic changes, and he's got a list, and if they don't happen, we're out of here. He's running the fastest growing, one of the largest unions. That split could be devastating for organized labor. Is it possible?
I think it's possible, although I really can't say how likely it is. I think that there probably are still some ways that a compromise might be reached. There's a fair amount of resentment by some leaders that Stern has been as out front and critical as he has been. But at the same time, there's a lot of feeling, even among people who disagree with him, that he sparked a very valuable internal debate and forced people to think about issues, talk about issues with each other in a relatively constructive, if somewhat tense, way. The big thing that he's pushing among a lot of ideas that have a fair amount of support is he thinks that there ought to be many fewer unions, bigger unions, and ones that are focused more on just a particular sector of the economy rather than being spread out over lots of different and often quite disparate industries.
You know, I was looking at a story recently about one attempt to reorganize or a merger of two unions, and the name of the union that came to my attention was the United Steel, Paper and Forestry, Rubber Manufacturing and Energy Allied Industrial and Service Workers Union. And I thought to myself, you know, maybe it is time that these things were taken apart and made more industry specific. But this is a real problem for labor because that kind of goes against the whole democratic nature of that underlies it. Can they resolve that?
Well, I don't think that there's much of any chance that Stern's ideas on restructuring are going to be accepted. Certainly, there's not any acceptance of the idea that somebody at the AFL-CIO should be able to dictate it. There may be some chance of getting an agreement for certain guidelines for what are good mergers and what are bad mergers, so that you don't have a case where there are small textile unions that are joining the food and commercial workers when they merge rather than joining the textile union. Things like that don't make much sense now, even to the leaders of the food and commercial workers union. So there may be agreement on things like that. I think that there may be an effort to try to get unions who are in the same industry to work more closely together, and that certainly makes an awful lot of sense and doesn't upset the apple cart and force dramatic internal changes in quite the same way. So I think that there are options that may not be completely satisfactory to Stern, but still push them, the unions, in the direction that I think they have to go, that they have to recognize that on the organizing front that they're all in it together and that they may have a lot of rivalries, they may have fights over who gets into what union. But ultimately, if they don't grow all together, each one of them, even the strong ones like the Service Employees Union, are going to be in trouble.
David, I want to thank you for being with us.
My pleasure.
David Moberg is senior editor of In These Times, talking to us there from Las Vegas, where the AFL-CIO's Executive Council is holding its crucial meeting. I want to turn to Barry Bluestone, who's sitting in the Connection studio with me. Barry's a professor of political economy at Northeastern University and director of that university's Center for Urban and Regional Policy, something of an expert on labor. Barry, nice to have you back in the studio.
Always nice to be here.
Do you think that this really is a crucial time for labor? I'm listening to David saying, well, they probably won't do this restructuring. They probably won't agree on that. And I'm thinking to themselves, if these guys don't blow something up, they may be in really serious trouble.
Well, it's been a crucial time for organized labor for 20 years. I mean, the fact is that they're finally coming to grips with some internal restructuring within the American Federation of Labor. And I think the important word is federation. And that is there's very little control centrally in the trade union movement in the United States. The real power is in every one of the individual unions, the steel workers, the auto workers, SEIU, AFSCME, which is the State, County, and Municipal Employees Union. So it's very difficult for the leadership, in this case John Sweeney, to kind of keep all those, you know, he's herding cats. It's very difficult to do that. But I think there's a much bigger problem than what goes on in terms of the kind of internal restructuring of the union. There has been a sea change in the economy. Even when companies are doing very well, they worry that next year they could be bought out. International competition can drive them out of business. Mm-hmm. Their profits and their stock prices are constantly under assault. And therefore, there's a lot more pressure on companies to operate lean, mean, and, if possible, non-union. And that's why you're seeing all of these companies going to extraordinary lengths, some of them actually illegal under the National Labor Relations Act, to keep unions out, the kind of case you talked about. The other, or that David Moberg talked about. So that's one change, is this great global economic change. The other is a demographic change.
Okay, but just before we leave that one, so what can labor do about that? I mean, how can you organize to get people to sign up in places that, such as David described it, at Walmart? It seems like a lost chance.
Well, it's very difficult to organize in some of those industries, but I think one of the major problems, this is very difficult, very ticklish for organized labor, is that you can't succeed in companies that are constantly on the brink of going out of business.
Like airlines.
Yeah. And what that means is that we need a real restructuring of the whole role of unions and to some extent the role of management. You have to have unions that are willing to step up with management to say, we've got to keep you profitable. That means we have to help you with your productivity, your quality, your innovation. But in return, we want a voice to make sure that our workers benefit from those improvements in productivity, quality,
and
innovation.
And is there still, under that, the room for the union to argue nose to nose for better wages and better benefits?
Right. As some union leaders have put it, you know, we have more in common in an international global economy than we have in conflict. We'll always have some conflict when it comes down to how do we split up the pie, but you first of all have to have a large pie to split up.
This hour, a conversation about what's happening within American labor unions as the AFL-CIO looks at its own structure out in Las Vegas. But what does it really mean for you? If someone asked you to sign a union card right now, knowing what you know about your own job security, would you sign the card? Do you think you'd get the kind of backup from the union that the unions used to be able to offer 20, 30, 40 years ago? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection this hour, a conversation about the place of the union in the American workplace. The unions themselves are talking about this, but it's something that comes up in a lot of different places, and we're interested in knowing how you're hearing and watching this conversation. 1-800-423-TALK. Back to Barry Bluestone here in the studio, just on the second point that you were making about the demographic changes that we need to take note of here, and what kind of difference are they making?
Well, we have a whole new generation of workers out there, Gen X, Gen Y, whatever you want to call them, the new millennials. And I think they are different than the generation that worked, let's say, in the 1940s, 50s, or 60s when my generation was working in the Ford plant building planned obsolescence into Ford Falcons. The younger worker wants to be treated as an individual, not as a collectivity. The younger worker doesn't want to be told, you can't move ahead until you get more seniority, even if you're a better worker, you have better ideas, what have you. Unions, in order to be able to keep their kind of collective being together, have created a set of rules that I don't think work very well for a lot of younger workers. Seniority rules, the way we set up who gets promoted, et cetera, who gets laid off first. I think unions have to figure out not only a way of working with management to make sure that firms are competitive and then get the best deal they can for the workers in a competitive firm, but they also have to have a new way of talking to younger workers. One of the problems is if you go to Las Vegas and you sit down with all our friends on that executive council, they're old people. There aren't a lot of young people. Andy Stern's one of the youngest, and he's
and they tend to be white, and they tend to be male.
I mean, right. There's been some increased diversity. There's some young people coming in. But in fact, there's a seniority system within the leadership, and it takes 10, 20, 30 years to rise to a position of power in one of the unions. We need younger people in the union movement.
I want to stick with the point that you raised about the history here, and it's a perfect place to bring Nelson Lichtenstein into the conversation. Nelson is director of the Center for Work, Labor, and Democracy at the University of California in Santa Barbara and a labor historian. He's been listening in on the phone. Hi, Nelson.
Hello there.
Are the workers today really that much different from workers 30, 40, 50 years ago?
Actually, I don't think so. I mean, naturally, there's different people and there are different ethnicities, and many more women are in the workplace. But you know, when you look at the grievances and problems of workers, we can go right back to the 19th century, and certain themes just appear again and again. They often are expressed in different ways, but themes such as dignity, themes such as a sense of sort of personhood on the job. Wages, of course, this is very, maybe even boring, but wages are always an issue.
Yeah.
And now, you know, one of the things that's quite remarkable about the union movement today is there's an effort, at least, and in some places, in places like Las Vegas and Los Angeles, Boston too, for that matter, an effort to organize immigrant workers, often, you know, workers without their correct papers. This is very similar to the great moments when the union movement got going, either the turn of the 20th century in places like New York and Philadelphia, where immigrant garment workers were being organized, or in the period of the 1930s, for that matter, when really the people who were being in the unions were we think of those white men, but actually what they were Italians and Lithuanians and Poles. They were immigrant workers whose sense of Americanism or American citizenship was pretty shaky in those days. And so, in one sense, the union movement is a great institution for making citizens, creating citizens with a full sense of rights and entitlements, and I think that remains the same.
Okay, but it's an interesting point that you raise, because becoming a union member today means to some people, because what they see on the television news, you know, carrying a political sign or going door to door canvassing for the Democrats, and one of the reasons why Andy Stern and labor leaders in the past, I think, were appealing to, you know, janitors and immigrant farm workers, is that they weren't saying, you're going to become part of this great large political organization, but you know what? We're going to get you a little bit more money on the job. We're going to get you a little bit more protection. We're going to make your life better. And I wonder if some of that hasn't been sapped out of the organizing business.
Well, yeah, to some extent, I mean, it is true, as others have said on your program, that it's much more difficult for unions to make progress, to make those sort of those very kind of parochial, almost old-fashioned, you know, ideas, just a few more, just another dollar or two an hour in an international economy, or in a period when management is very, very hostile to unions, and partly because they're worried of competition either here or abroad. So that is much more difficult, and that means the payoff for becoming a union member. Hey, if I'm not going to get any benefits out of it, why do it? People have that view as well. But, you know, unions have always been sort of had more than one function. It's management that wants to make unions as parochial as possible and then say, oh, look, don't join that organization. Just sort of parochial, has no vision, so why join it? They've always been two-sided. One is these very bread-and-butter demands, but the other is a sense of participation, citizenship, dignity, and that is not to be underestimated. When you have a Cesar Chavez, when you have even a Walter Reuther in his salad days, even a John L. Lewis who spoke of industrial democracy back in the 1930s, that's an important impulse. And I think the unions need to recapture that.
Okay, we'll get back to some of that, but I want to make sure that our callers have room to join us. So we're going to go first to Lansing, Michigan. Michael's on the line. Hi, Michael.
How you doing?
I'm fine, thanks. Auto workers?
Excuse me?
I said auto workers?
actually, no, I'm with the service workers.
Okay.
And the irony is that we are the fastest growing union. You see the power that Andy Stern has, but the local that I have been a part of hasn't won a campaign for over 2 years. And I feel that there are many problems going on right now. I feel that
problems within the union leadership, problems on the shop floor. What are you talking about?
I think it's a combination of many different problems. First of all, I feel that the unions have not been proactive enough. I know many people in leadership in the Michigan AFL-CIO, and there are only a handful of unions that are even organizing right now. And they are desperately just trying to hold on to the members that they have right now, let alone try to organize more. And I also believe that the union leadership has fallen behind corporate America. Corporate America has been extremely intelligent in hiring union busters, in hiring lawyers, in hiring ways to look at how to divide workers. And
you do some organizing, is that right, Michael? How do you make the case? If you're saying to somebody you're better off inside a union than not, how are you making the case now so someone's going to stop and listen?
Well, the biggest fear that people have right now is losing their job. You know, the economy may be improving, but you don't see it here in Michigan. And the biggest case is the fact that you have so many more protections when you have a union.
Okay, but let's talk about what happened with that Walmart up in Quebec in Canada. They actually successfully signed up enough of the employees to certify the union there, and Walmart shut the store down. Everybody was put out of work. They weren't just suspended. That was the end of it. So you go to somebody with Walmart, everybody knows this story now, Michael, and say, would you like to join the union? They'll go, no, you guys aren't going to protect my job. You're going to lose my job.
Well, and of course, that's not an issue for SEIU or AFSCME in many cases, because a lot of them are public employees, and they're probably not going to eliminate the governments, and they're probably not going to eliminate the museums or eliminate, you know, some of the social services, although things can get cut. But that isn't a big issue in that case. But I understand for private corporations, absolutely it's a concern. And that will even affect, if you're trying to organize state employees, that's even going to affect their views, seeing what happens in Walmart. And I think going back to the political discussion, if you have a president who is pro-labor, if you have political leaders that are pro-labor, it's going to make the climate better as well.
If you were talking to Andy Stern, would you say time to leave the AFL-CIO, time to operate on our own?
I think he's doing the right thing right now. I think what he is trying to do is he is trying to shake things up. He's trying to get Sweeney to move. And I think there are a lot of people that are complacent. And I think that as membership goes down every single day, as people are decertifying, I don't know if you've discussed that yet, but that's actually people that have union protections and choose to go without them.
You know, when I listen, excuse me, Michael, I want to bring Barry in here. When I listen to Michael talking about, you know, that small comfort zone that exists for public employees, and who are we talking about here, teachers and police and firefighters and government workers, is that where unions will end up? Are we talking about a circumstance where there won't be unions in the private sector?
The only reason why we still have about 13% or 14% of American workers organized has been the 40% plus that are organized in the public sector.
Right.
And again, it's the global economy which makes it so difficult to organize in the private sector. The state of Michigan is not going to leave the United States, but a General Motors plant can. And that makes it much more difficult in all kinds of industries. I think one of the most important points here, though, is how do you galvanize a young leadership in the unions? You go back to the 1930s and then the 1940s. You had people like Walter Reuther, who was just mentioned, of the UAW. He was in his 30s when he was president of the UAW in the 1940s. He was leading a revolution among workers. And the workers in the plant were his age. I mean, these were people he could identify with. The leadership has gotten older and older and older. It hasn't refreshed itself. And as a result, much of the trade union movement is a little bit sclerotic and needs to be shaken up the way Andy wants to do it. But it's going to have to not only start at the top, it has to go all the way down to the bottom. There have to be opportunities for young organizers, like the one we're talking with now, to move up in the ranks and really play a role in these unions.
And Nelson, I remember a piece that Matt By wrote about the fellow who's head of the machinist union. What's his name?
Buffenbarger.
Trying to defend why he needed his own Learjet to do his work. I mean, that's an example of what Barry's talking about, isn't it? That even if they are a little leaner than they've been, the image is that the unions themselves have become business.
Oh, there's no doubt about that in many respects. Although I have to say that today, this is probably a little bit less the case than it was, say, 15 years ago, before the Sweeney people came in, although Sweeney's in his, 60s or something? He's 70, I think, now. Nevertheless, there was a bit of a revolt there, and when he came in, he brought in a bunch of somewhat younger people. Can I make another comment?
Yeah, can you be quick? Because I do want to get back to our callers.
I think basically, actually, it's a little bit less the global economy is the problem. That is a problem, but it's mainly that management has become, in the last 30 years, absolutely intransigent in its opposition to unions. And this is as much a legal and ideological question as it is one of competition.
1-800-423-8255 to Chapel Hill, North Carolina. John's with us. Hi, John.
Hello. I hope I can articulate this well enough. And what the gentleman just said before is pretty much right on, is that, you know, that a lot of the management has the unions running. I work for a company. Our parent company is called Aramark. It's a food service company.
Yeah.
And we feed all of the students at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Now I'm 40-something years old. I'm kind of embarrassed to say that I only make $8 an hour. And there's been a written edict handed down that we have a new food service facility opening, And if there's any organizers, anybody that's caught talking to organizers, anybody that's, you know, seen grouping at work or out of work talking about union organization, is to be fired. And I'm kind of hoping here, you know, unions, like was mentioned before, was kind of the basis of people having, you know, a living wage. I'm kind of wondering where the unions are, and kind of hoping that they'd run to the rescue, because $8 an hour, I think anybody would agree. I mean, talking about a nation that's turning into, you know, having no middle class, and it's just haves and have-nots, I'm really, really wondering if they're wondering why they don't have the numbers. And with food service, the economy is going all over the service economy. Where are these people?
John, just hang with me for half a second here. I want to check something with Barry Bluestone. Is it legal for Aramark to make those rules? You can't talk to organizers. If we catch you talking to an organizer,
they're actually completely illegal under the National Labor Relations Act. The problem is we now have a National Labor Relations Board, which is heavily influenced by the Republicans who dominate it.
Right.
And they are overturning older regulations that make it much easier for management to fight against unions, make it much more difficult for unions to do organizing drives. The whole idea behind the National Labor Relations Act, passed in 1935 under Franklin Roosevelt, was to give a level playing field so that unions had a right to organize, and it was, quote-unquote, an unfair labor practice for a company to fire organizers or to threaten to leave, threaten to move the plant unless they had an economic reason for doing it. Today, those kinds of violations go on all the time, and the federal government basically looks the other way.
I want to go back to Michael here, because I'm curious to know how you and your workers see the current circumstances. I'm sorry, John in Chapel Hill. You know, our grandfather's generation, in many cases, was willing to sort of blockade workplaces and demand the rights for some kind of union representation when they thought their working conditions were so awful that they really couldn't stay with it. Do you get any of that kind of sentiment from the people you work with, John?
Well, the thing is, absolutely, but we have nobody from the union showing up, you know, either in our workplace or coming out and talking to us after work. And I mean, From what I can understand...
Wait a second. If someone from the union did come, would you talk to them, or would you be afraid of losing your job?
I would be very afraid of losing my job, because that's what it said in the letter that I wasn't supposed to see, but I saw that if you see anybody on campus, if you're seen talking to anybody, if you're wearing a union button, if you have union literature, anything like this, you're history.
John, I thank you for calling. A reminder to our listeners, you're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. And Nelson, just a question to you about what unions need to do in this call, even amongst themselves, for some kind of new organizing. How do they operate in an environment that seems so controlled by the kind of management edict that John was describing?
Right. I think the analogy that the unions have to think about, and which some is less sort of a traditional union organizing model, but then more a social movement of the sort in the South, for example, of the civil rights movement. When you think of the obstacles that faced that movement before the era of reform in the 60s, you know, the kind of fear, the kind of intimidation, that's what unions face today. And what happened was a kind of transformation in the political culture and in social norms. And today it's true. For example, a large corporation would be totally embarrassed if a letter of the about race or discrimination against women was surfaced. And when they do, these corporations quickly make amends. The same has to be the atmosphere has to be changed so that corporations are embarrassed when this kind of information about their anti-union activities come out. That is clearly not the case, but I think that's one of the tasks of not just unionists sitting in Las Vegas, but actually lots of people in the United States who are may not be directly related to the connected union movement, but are in other doing other things, and they want to see a sort of progressive reform in America. We have to change this political culture. When you get to Walmart, you're not going to organize Walmart in a kind of, you know, one lube shop after another. It's going to require a kind of national shift in the way we think about the importance of work and the importance of workers' rights.
All right. Connection listeners, 1-800-423-8255. In these last few minutes, we've heard words like respect and dignity attached to the union as a way of giving people perhaps the wages that they're not getting at the workplace. Do you think the union could make the difference at the place where you work? 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Dick Gordon, you're listening to The Connection, and this hour a conversation about the future of organized labor in America. Barry Bluestone is with me here. He's a professor at Northeastern University. Nelson Lichtenstein is on the line from California. He is a labor historian, and we're joined now from Las Vegas by Rick Trumka. He holds the number two job in the AFL-CIO. He's the secretary treasurer and is a former president of the United Mine Workers. Spent a lot of time with that union. Rick, it's good of you to join us on the program.
Thanks for having me on, Dick. I appreciate it very much.
You know, a lot of the criticism that we're hearing on the program today is, in fact, aimed at senior people in the AFL-CIO, people like you, and people saying that you guys need to be more open to more radical shifts in the way that unions are organized and how you go after new members. Are those the topics you're talking about in Las Vegas?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, working people in this country face tremendous pressures right now. And we're undergoing a pretty historic debate. We're trying to find out not only what workers want and need, but what we have to look like and what we have to become to meet those wants and needs. So we're looking at everything. Everything is up on the table. We know that we have to do two competing things at the same time with a very, very hostile environment, a hostile administration, and a hostile corporate America who has unprecedented power. We have to organize more. But we also have to look at all the public policies that are sucking the life out of America, sucking jobs out of this country, and figure out a way to combat that as well. So the debate now is not about whether we change, it's about what we change to. It's been a very, very interesting debate so far. It's been good for us, and I hope it continues, because the best thing we can do is continue to change to meet the needs of working people and to help America save jobs and have an economy that really rewards everybody.
I mean, what we've heard from people so far in the program is that your organizing efforts just aren't keeping pace with the changes and the evolutions at the corporate level and at the political level, that you're being left behind, and that's why workers aren't joining.
Well, there's some truth to that. We organize 500,000 people, and you lose 500,000 or a million because of bad trade deals or because of privatization, because of deregulation, because of a hostile administration and a hostile corporate America who has taken control of the government. You do have to look at new ways to do things. We do have to look at ways to reach out. We have an organization called Working America where just last year we brought in 800,000 new workers to join us in the fight to make America more sane, to save good jobs, to have an economy that works for everyone, to have health care for everyone, to have pension security for everyone, and wages that really reward people for work and not punish them for staying on the job.
Rick, I know you're busy out there, but we're a call-in program here, and we've a number of people on the line. I'm going to ask you if you'll talk to Peter, who's on the line from Boston.
Dick, I will, but I have to tell you, we're so pressed out here.
I get you. Let's just hear what Peter has to say about his view of labor unions, and we'll hear from you and then bid you farewell. Fair enough? Peter, you go ahead.
Thanks, Dick. Rick, thanks for taking the call. Excuse my cold. Terrific show. I'm glad you folks are meeting out there. I was a UAW member in 1978, went on to university training. I'm a tenured professor in a prestigious school in Boston. Every time I ride past a small shop with a union members out front striking, my heart goes out to them. I see people drive by without even turning their head. Worse yet, I see union members walking in and purchasing products in those stores across the board. My point is, and my comment is, that I think leadership has lost sight of its mission. And
that it needs to be more of a social movement, that it needs to take in something other than just the raises for workers. Let's hear from Rick on that. I know, Rick, your time's tight.
Yeah, it really is, and we're trying to do exactly that. I mean, we are the voice for working people, not just union people, but we actually, union workers help all workers in America. It's us that's defending Social Security right now. It's the labor movement that's defending pension security right now. And as I said earlier, last year we brought in 800,000 people that were not coming in with us for collective bargaining, but wanted a voice in politics. That they were tired of the direction that this country's going in. They don't like the trade deals. They don't like the privatization. They don't like the deregulation. They don't like the fact that they don't have health care. They don't like the fact that wages are stagnating. They don't like the fact that they're trying to take away defined benefits.
You ever think you'll get those people to sign a union card, though, Rick?
Well, hopefully they will. Because now they're starting to say that not only do they like unions, but unions are the solution to their problem. You know, look, I'm not saying we're perfect. We're still the best institution in America to give voice to working families. We're working hard to change so that we can work hard for working Americans and give them what they need and deserve. We have an economy right now that increases productivity and passes those gains on to everybody but the people that produce those gains, and that's the workers in America. You know, do we have a lot of way to go? Yeah. Is corporate America stronger than it's ever been? Yes, it is. Have they taken control of this government? Lock, stock, and barrel own this government right now. That's why it's important for us to look at ourselves and say, we'll change and we'll do what we have to do to remain a strong voice and a balance to that corporate power so that workers get their fair share. That's where we're headed this week.
Thanks for your time, Rick.
You bet. Thank you very much.
Rick Trumka is Secretary-Treasurer of the AFL-CIO. That's the number two person in a 13-million-member organization representing working people. Barry Bluestone, this is a man that you know, that you've talked with. When he makes the case for getting that large a number of people engaged in a union movement, is he... I mean, is he in fantasy land? Can it happen?
No, he's not. He's not at all. And he's one of the great creative leaders of the union today. He comes out of the CIO, which was a social movement in the 1930s and in some ways has remained a social movement. What he's talking about in terms of the Work in America Institute and the programs they have is organizing people who are not necessarily able to join a union. Mm-hmm. They can't get a majority of people in their plant or their shop to join a union, but they want to be part of the union movement as a political and social movement for all the things they believe in, securing Social Security, all the other things that Rick Trumka talked about. I think that's part of what the union movement has to do. It has to begin to organize workers as workers when they can get them into a majority organized so they can have a collective bargaining contract. Great, and we need much more of that. But the union movement is going to have to reach out to people, and if they can only get 20% of the people in a particular place to join up with them, they should go after that 20%, work with them, build a social movement, build a political movement. And that's one way I think we're going to start rebuilding workers' power in this country to take on their responsibility to deal with all the issues that Rick's talking about.
Just a quick word, Nelson, from you on that. I mean, is really the future of organized labor in the kind of political movement and social movement that Barry's talking about, or is it more basics for the workers? Get me a wage that I can live on, get me some job security, get me some benefits.
Well, the two go together, but in this case where it's so the labor law is structured from the Wagner Act forward, that that unless you have a union is recognized by the employer, then you aren't a member of the union. You can have 49% of a shop that office that wants to be in a union, but if they lose the election, then what's usually happened from both the employer's point of view and the union's point of view is you say goodbye to those workers. Now we know that in many, many workplaces, people want to be part of something, an organization. They may not have what's called exclusive jurisdiction. They may not have a signed union contract, mm-hmm. but the union movement had better represent them. And I think when you start doing that, you do become more of a social movement, more of a political formation than a kind of traditional collective bargaining institution.
Let's go to Auburn, Massachusetts. Russ is on the line from there. Russ, thanks for waiting.
Thanks a lot. I enjoy the show. I was a Teamster for 30 years, and my father, my dad was a Teamster since the early 30s. And so I grew up in that environment. And to me, it hasn't really gotten bad enough yet for a lot of people, for masses to kind of – I remember my father talking about the revolts they had in, sit-ins and out in Minneapolis and Minnesota. They had riots, and I mean, it's radical and extreme. But sometimes I was through seven strikes myself in the 30 years. And then they had the worker replacement law. We tried to repeal that. And if you will go on strike, they can replace you with replacement workers. And some of the states have what they call right-to-work states, where you join a union. But if you're not a member of the union and work for the company, you still get the same benefits as if you belong. So why should I pay my dues when in an open shop in a right-to-work state? It's just it's gone. I hope that it comes back, because I'm afraid it'll have to collapse to the point of everybody being so bad off, and they'll finally realize what they had, but it's too late, you know.
I'm wondering, Nelson, if you would agree with what Russ is saying, that we actually may be going to a time when, who knows, immigrant strawberry pickers in Florida or people at a McDonald's somewhere in the country get into a confrontation situation in order to try and draw attention to their desire to get some of the benefits that a union can bring them. Do you think that's inevitable?
Well, I mean, I think that actually happens right now. We have these sort of all over the country, these little kind of moments. That sometimes they make it in the newspaper. Sometimes they just they're there under the radar screen. This happens all the time. What's happened is that the imbalance in power is so great that the people there, as the individual from North Carolina said, they just get fired or thrown out. What you need is a institution and a kind of moment in which these results come symbolic of larger questions, and then they can have an impact. This thing in Colorado where 17 workers in a lube shop had a vote, it received national press attention, and the reason was not that anyone thought these guys would win, but that Walmart is a problem. I mean, it's an issue facing the entire nation, and lots of people, not just unionists, are concerned about it.
1-800-423-8255, next to Boston, and Catherine's with us. Hi, Catherine.
Hi. I think one of the biggest questions out there is about industry organizing and organizing by industry. And, you know, it seems to me we've got multinational corporations that are organized by industry, hotel corporations, et cetera. And if we're going to build worker power, it seems like we have to take the corporations on in the same way that they're structured and match that.
This is what Andy Stern has been talking about, and is getting some resistance from within sort of established organized labor. Do you come at this from a union perspective, Catherine?
Yeah, I'm actually an organizer with Unite here, and I work with hotel workers. And, you know, I think with the criticism that Andy Stern's been getting is talking a lot about democracy. And, you know, I actually think, talking to workers every day, that democracy is really about building a worker-led union by building committees of natural leaders. And, you know, the question of democracy on a local level, I actually think there's a lot of organizational ego involved in that on the part of, you know, the resistance.
So are you saying that you don't want the mine workers representing people who are working at a Wendy's? Are you saying that kind of sort of every union's grab for as many members that it can get is in fact hurting the movement?
Well, I think so. I mean, you know, I think it dilutes an ability to organize and have real strength and power.
Let me, if I can, Kathy, just test that a little bit further on the program. A reminder, you're listening to The Connection. My name's Dick Gordon. Barry, what about that dilemma of,
well,
you know, can you,
you know,
could you take 60 unions, break them up, rebuild 20 industry-specific unions and say, there, you guys will do transportation, you guys will do hotels?
It's very difficult for two reasons. One, you have leadership already there, and some of that leadership is now going to get laid off. Workers, you know, unions are not supposed to lay off their own people. The other problem you have, though, is that as the union memberships have declined, you know, as General Motors and Ford and Chrysler have shrunk, the UAW has been opportunistic in trying to organize who they can. And if they have somebody who used to be in a UAW and loved the local and now they're working at a Wendy's or wherever it is, they'll sometimes try and bring that union in. So, you know, you organize where you can because you need to be able to keep your dues up in order to run your union. So it's very, very tough to do it. But I'm not sure, and I'm a great fan of Andy Stern's, I'm not sure that that's much of the answer to what ails the trade union movement and what ails workers. I think much more is in what Nelson was talking about, what I was talking about, others have been talking about, turning the union movement back into a social movement the way it once was. And if you think about it, the Democratic Party has been the way for workers generally.
So what's the bumper sticker there? What's the how do you tell someone who's making $8 an hour and afraid for his job that you're an organizer and you want him to be part of a social movement? And, you know, we'll worry about your...
It's a little bit like Workers of the World Unite. It has a lot to do with, in this new global economy, workers have a lot in common. They're workers who are professionals and they're workers who are working in services,
yeah.
And they're both facing employers that can make them redundant very quickly and lay them off. We need a force in this country that speaks loudly for all workers, not just the 12 or 13% that are members of unions. Unions should play that role. And if they do, they can begin to rebuild their strength. And as they rebuild their strength and have more political impact, they're going to be able to change the climate. And when they can change the climate, we're going to also organize people into collective bargaining units.
And Nelson, it would seem to me that one essential element of that is persuading consumers that they too need to support the idea of American-made goods or union-made goods. And that doesn't appear to be the case right now. Nobody shopping at Walmart is thinking too much about what the effect of that purchase might be on a job in their own community or halfway across the country.
Well, right. Well, I mean, there's nothing wrong with low prices for and the efficiency of a company like Walmart in generating low prices. That's a good thing. It's like when you built the assembly line 100 years ago. It was a good thing to have cheap cars. But I think that consumers can be educated and have been in various places. That's why we've had these tremendous fights about whether Walmart will come into Queens or into Chicago or into San Francisco. They aren't completely automatons who only look for the lowest price. They understand the whole sort of world that the new social regime that a Walmart brings with it when it comes into our neighborhood, which is why there's been this opposition to it. Unions and others have always been concerned both with the price and with the wage, and I think that the tremendous amount of publicity about Walmart is because this is a company like Amarok in North Carolina that is reducing the general wage level, not just of Walmart workers, but of everyone. So I think that's an issue. I think that isn't having the effect of nationalizing and making a national conversation, not just a union conversation, about key questions in the American economy.
Very briefly, Barry, do you think Walmart is going to be the employer that will turn this or that will focus people's attention on it?
Well, it does because it's so gargantuan. I mean, you even get Macy's and Filene's merging because they have to compete with these guys. And the fact is they're so large that they are responsible for the changing culture. And if you don't approach them, if you don't really aggressively go after the Walmartization of America, God knows where we go.
Thanks so much for coming in. Nice to have you back. Barry Bluestone, professor of political economy and director of the Center for Urban and Regional Policy at Northeastern University here in Boston. Nelson Lichtenstein, thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Welcome.
Nelson's a labor historian and director of the Center for Work, Labor, and Democracy at the University of California, Santa Barbara. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Rick Trumka, secretary-treasurer at the AFL-CIO, and David Moberg, senior editor at In These Times. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.